across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. The sun is shining across the rooftops of London town after an epic snowfall yesterday gave everyone a welcome respite from sitting in the house staring at the four walls wondering what excuse to use for venturing out into the great outdoors. We are stuck, ladies and gentlemen, in a prison not of our own making. Unable to travel, unable to visit friends, unable to have people over for drinks or anything else, unable to send our children to school, unable to go to work, unable to go to a gym or out for a swim, and generally marooned in a sea of nothingness. It's awful, isn't it? Meanwhile, some children are going to school, thousands of people are travelling, many families are happily waddling around in supermarket aisles, and hordes are crowding onto public transport as adverts tell us not to go out in case we kill people, despite assurances that millions of people might have COVID without knowing it because they don't have any symptoms. It's a bit of a confusing picture generally, isn't it? Has there ever been a more frustrating time to be alive? 0344 499 1000. Coming up this morning, we're talking to SDP leader William Clouston on the 40th anniversary of the founding of his party. So much has changed since that was happening way back then. And we wonder whether we will ever see the like of the kind of politicians that left the Labour Party and joined themselves up as the Social Democrats. We'll be talking, of course, also to Peter Hitchens. He joins us for another conversation about the state of things, the latest COVID statistics, and those who would silence critics of government policy on lockdown. Yes, that's right. They've all been busy at the weekend again, trying to tell us all that we're COVID deniers, telling us all that, you know, we are a disgrace to humanity. One particular bozo who works for The Observer called Nick Cohen actually made out that what we do here at Talk Radio is actually dangerous and is no different from what people are who tell you not to take a vaccine. How absolutely and utterly ridiculous. And he also used disgracefully the death of a COVID denier, somebody who actually did say that it was a hoax, to make his political point. What an absolute and utter ghastly individual. 0344 499 1000. We'll also be talking about the big schools debate. If we are going to wait until the summer term before allowing children back into buildings, what kind of effect is that going to have on a generation of young minds? Steve Bryan, Tory MP, joins us. He agrees with me that we should be getting the kids back to school as soon as possible. Also, we'll be talking to author and academic Helen Pluckrose, who is setting up a new organisation aiming to be the Citizens Advice Bureau for the Culture Wars. As ever, of course, we need to hear from you. How are you coping at home? What are you hearing from work or from your children's school? Do let us know. You tell us and we tell everyone else. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, time to say a very good morning and a welcome right now to the opening show of the week, Mr. William Clouston, leader of the Social Democratic Party. We do so just as Keir Starmer has notified everyone that he's going to be self-isolating again after coming into contact with someone who has tested positive for COVID-19. He says, I have no symptoms and I'll be working from home until next Monday. So that, by my reckoning, is the third time that Keir Starmer has been self-isolated because he has come into contact with somebody who had COVID. They seem to get it a lot more than everybody else, these politicians, don't they? Unbelievable. 0344 499 1000. William, a very good morning to you.
Morning. Great to be back. Thank you.
Yes, no, thank you very much indeed on this auspicious day for your party, 40th anniversary. I mean, it's one of those dates that a lot of people listening perhaps won't remember as well as you and I do. But it was quite a massive sea change in the political world, wasn't it, at the time? And it struck me when I was looking at the pictures this morning of the launch of the SDP 40 years ago, what substantial figures those four people were. Shirley Williams, you know, and the others. Absolutely extraordinary kind of individuals, very smart, very clever. Tell us a bit about it and why it happened.
Well, it is a massive day for us as well to celebrate it. We take our history very seriously and we'll be celebrating up and down the country. It is the 40th anniversary of the issuing of the Limehouse Declaration, which was the founding document of the SDP. What was it? Well, it was basically four very, very senior Labour Party politicians that decided that politics wasn't working in this country and decided to try and make it better. They left and set up the SDP. And the SDP was, anyone old enough to remember in the 80s, it was the biggest challenge to the two-party setup in British political history. I'm sad to say it wasn't successful in the 80s in changing the system, but we continue to fight for a change and argue for it.
Yes, indeed. And the four people who were involved, I mean, Roy Jenkins, as I said, Shirley Williams, David Owen and Bill Rogers, I think it was. They were all big beasts of the Labour Party in a way. I mean, Bill Rogers maybe slightly to a lesser extent, but they were all very well thought of individuals. And it struck me that we don't have those kinds of politicians really in any great numbers anymore.
Yeah, I think there has been a decline in the quality of frontline politicians, and I don't think there's any doubt about that. They were very, very big figures. Jenkins, former Home Secretary and Chancellor and Deputy Leader of the Labour Party. George Brown, the Deputy Leader of the Labour Party in the 60s, joined. David Owen, a major figure, former Foreign Secretary and so on. So, yeah, I mean, huge figures. I think that the decline in the quality of politicians generally is not just on the Labour side. I think the Tories, if you want to look at, you know, a decent cabinet, have a look. I mean, I didn't agree with them at the time. But if you want to have a look at a good quality cabinet, look at the photograph of Mrs. Thatcher's first cabinet in 79. I would calculate about 12 or 13, 14 of those members of the cabinet would have been worthy prime ministers on quality. So, yeah, there has been a decline, and there are many reasons for that. But the basic message that the SDP tried to get across was actually, you know, highly subversive, really. It was quite revolutionary, which is that we should get away from vested interests in politics. You know, I think many of the problems that we identified back 40 years ago are still around. I mean, you've still got a vested interest basis to politics. You've still got the Labour Party. Every time it gets in, it just looks after the public sector. I know people might argue about this now, but broadly speaking, the Tories look after the business interests.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to occur to them that there's a balance between those things and you can govern the interests of the whole country.
Mm. Well, as you say, there is a slight wrinkle, I suppose, to that summation of the way things are, which I agree with, by the way. I don't think you're wrong, because what they do apparently now is look after the business interests that they want to look after. And they've now thrown to the wolves the business interests that they don't care about. And I suppose that's where it's different, because that, in a way, is more insidious than it was.
Yeah, they do seem incapable of seeing the bigger whole. Mm. But that's, as I say, that's just a sort of pathology in politics generally. And it doesn't occur to people that, you know, very, very successful societies offer a blend of market and state and have, you know, a strong and capable state, but you know, value-free enterprise and prize it, because that's where the wealth is generated. And again, the balance, neither of the duopoly parties seem to get the balance right. The Lib Dems now are actually a joke as a party. I mean, declining rapidly. I think they're in real trouble.
Yeah.
When we launched the sort of resurgence in the SDP, I said a couple of years ago, my aim would be to replace them within 10 years. And we're very realistic. And I think that's achievable given the way they are. I mean, I think they're not even celebrating today, the Lib Dems. They've completely lost the plot.
Yes, they have. Well, they don't really know what they stand for. I mean, last time I heard Ed Davey speak, he was talking about going around the country to ask people what he should stand for, you know, which in my view is kind of the wrong way round. If you're a politician, surely you should stand for something and try to convince other people that they should believe in you.
Yeah, just to get onto the Lib Dems, it's very interesting. So they technically, they have real problems. You won't get anywhere in politics unless you believe in something, unless you have a clear idea of what your foundational system is. And the Lib Dems now have three separate ideas. It's not a big party anymore. It's only got about 4 or 5% of the vote.
Right.
And within that 4 or 5% of the vote, they're representing three things. You have these sort of proper liberals, classical liberals, Gladstonian free trade types, Orange Book. I mean, that's fine. That's a fine tradition. It's not my politics, but it's a fine tradition. But, you know, frankly, Mike, there are more of those type of liberals in the Tory party than there are in the Lib Dems. Mm. And then you've got the sort of wokey types like Leila Moran. Now, I can't see any difference between the woke attitude that they have and the woke attitudes they get in the Labour Party. I mean, they may as well, those people basically should just go away and join the Labour Party.
Maybe they should just form a new party called the Woke Party.
Well, they've got it. It's the Labour Party.
I mean, without wishing to get too theoretical here, I mean, we also have two leaders of the two main parties who don't apparently believe in much either. I mean, I've no idea what Keir Starmer actually believes in, because he sort of blows with the prevailing wind. And Boris Johnson, we keep hearing, is a libertarian, but everything that he does would appear to suggest that that's not true.
I think, Mike, I think they are actually, I think actually all of them, this is a problem, all of them are just different types of liberals, and they're all pretty woke, Mike. There is a major misalignment between what the public thinks out there in the hinterland and what parliamentarians think. Again, one of the things that the SDP tried to shift 40 years ago was this misalignment between what, you know, the people in parliament and out there in the country. And you saw this. I mean, I saw lots of interviews post 2016 that you did about Brexit.
Yeah.
You know, and the basic problem was that the politicians in that institution in parliament were way out of alignment with what people thought in the country. The mainstream moderate position was to leave the EU, but the parliament was chock-a-block full of liberals of various kinds. Now, if you want to change that, you've got to change the voting system, because, you know, there are challenger parties, there are people with a different view, but this rigged system that we have basically locks us out. And until you change that, you won't get a parliament that in any way reflects the divisions in society.
But the difficulty with any other form of electoral system, aside from first past the post, is that they also all have their own problems, don't they? Because in the end, what you can end up with is a kind of Scottish situation where you either become like a one-party state where nobody really has much power at all, or you get a sort of constant stream of various coalitions being made.
Well, you do. I don't think there's no perfection under the sun, Mike. But, you know, frankly, I mean, remember, don't pretend that Labour and the Tories aren't coalitions anyway. I mean, they're massive, massive coalitions. From in the Labour Party, you've got, you know, Marxists right through to sort of social democrats with socialists in the middle. And you've got a lot of people. And the Tories are the same. You've got you've got one or two traditional social and moral conservatives left in there, but most of them are liberals, and you've got a broad range. The only difference is that basically the coalition is done by those two big parties, and then they put the coalition platform to the public. I mean, we would argue that why don't people vote honestly for what they want, get that representation in parliament, and then do the coalition? I think that's a clearer, more transparent way of doing it.
Yeah, I mean, certainly up in Scotland at one point when the SNP had to form a coalition with the Green Party, it then turned out that an awful lot of policy became greener as a result. Fair enough, I suppose you could argue that that's the case. However, not that many people voted for the Green Party, and they had a disproportionate, I would say, influence on government policy just because they were the ones that had done the deal with the government.
Yeah, no, I take that point. I think that's fair. I mean, I don't think Scottish politics is a very apt comparison anyway, because I think it is, frankly, distorted by the SNP separatism. And that dominates.
Well, there's some very strange things going up there as well, which we will probably address later in the week. It's probably too complex to get into now, but there's some very odd questions being asked and not very many answers coming back.
There are. I mean, but as I say, the whole Scottish politics is distorted by this SNP project. And I think it's utter disgrace. The SNP can start campaigning for another referendum during a pandemic. I mean, what are they thinking of?
Well, I know. It's absolutely extraordinary. And also, by kind of misappropriating British government funds and not spending them properly, which is apparently what's been going on, and then claiming they don't get enough money. I mean, it's quite disingenuous, if not worse. But let's talk a little bit about where we are now as well, William, because obviously we'll come back to the two-party system and how difficult it is to break through that if you are a different party. But looking at the landscape of the next few weeks, it doesn't look like we're going to be moving anywhere anytime soon. I'm looking at some figures from Public Health England this week, the executive summary of the COVID-19 and National Influenza report. They say that in week two, the case numbers started to go down, infection rates started to go down. Now, we're told all the time that lockdown and its effects do not really kick in for at least 3 to 4 weeks. So if they're, you know, seeing infection rates going down in the second week of January, that would tend to suggest, would it not, that they were coming down anyway?
There's never been a very clear link empirically between the time that lockdowns are put on and the peak of the viral curves. Frankly, it's quite a weak link, actually. I mean, in the very first wave in March, actually, the peak was prior to the lockdown and so on. So these things are quite weak. I think the point on lockdown resistance politically, you've got to keep on up making the case.
Yep.
We've never asked for very much as a party. We've only asked that the government should try and look at the costs of suppression measures to try and quantify them. to try and even acknowledge that there are some costs. That's been our argument all along. I think the point is moot because I don't think they're going to move on any of this stuff. I think what is encouraging, if you look at Saturday's vaccination total, I mean, that's very impressive. Nearly 500,000.
Yeah.
So, you know, that I think basically, hopefully in a few, literally in a matter of weeks, we've got to be looking at unlocking and getting on.
Well, you would think so. But you would like to think that you'd then be hearing that sort of noise being made by the government rather than this kind of consistent scaremongering. Boris Johnson at it again on Friday, talking about how this new variant might actually be more deadly and might kill more people than the last one. Turns out there was no scientific basis for that whatsoever.
Yeah, that they find out, don't they, a few weeks later. But the government have been from the start pretty keen. I think it's basically, Mike, it's the reason why they haven't been willing to look at any of the broader costs and the long-term costs, because they're just hammering a single message. And anything that helps that single message, they will hammer, so they'll use it. But I mean, if you stand back and look at some of the data, some of the things they're saying don't make actually a great deal of sense. They're talking about, the South African strain, what is it, 80 people tested positive for that in the UK? Well, you've got over 1 million people with COVID currently in the UK. So, I mean, frankly, that is a drop in the ocean. Whatever the differences are, I mean, I'm not underplaying it, but I think any message that the government can use to frighten people and to continue the policy,
continuing not to do anything and continuing to keep schools closed, continuing to damage young minds, continuing to frustrate people's ability to make a living. And when I was looking at some other figures, and I'm always asking for these, about the numbers of people who get COVID, go into hospital and then get released because they don't actually die, apparently out of 1,000 people over 60 who got COVID and were admitted to hospital, basically 10 would die under the old first wave of the virus.
Yeah.
Now, apparently it's 13. That's still an incredibly low number out of 1,000.
Yeah, not a huge amount of data either. I mean, as I say, I think we're just in, I'm hoping we're in a situation now where thankfully this country is doing rather well on the vaccinations. And apart from Israel, it's basically it's the biggest total of any large country. And again, you've got to feel sorry, actually, frankly, for the Europeans who've been totally hampered by their own bureaucracy and seem incapable of rolling out a vaccine across the various member states with any efficiency. And all those people that said that things were better with a large centralized bureaucracy, I think have been proved wrong. It's actually nation states have done rather better, but that's a separate point.
Yes, no, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, the one thing that Britain has been very successful at is the rollout of the vaccination, and that can only be applauded. But by the same token, as you say, I mean, people are now calling, Robert Halfen this morning, calling for a roadmap out of this. I've been calling for that for the last 2 weeks at minimum. Julie Hartley Brewer and I have been banging this particular drum probably for the best part of the last 3 months, and only now are actual MPs starting to make noises about it.
You've got to keep the pressure up, and certainly the criticism of people that have been sceptical or even questioned the measures from the start is a disgrace in a democracy. I thought we were allowed to ask questions here. I thought we were.
Well, I'm sorry. It's not about whether they allow us. It's about our right to do so.
Yeah, exactly. That's precisely my point. And I think you should. I mean, unless we have some scrutiny, unless you have some people questioning things, basically the government can do what it likes. So no, it's a public duty to question. Actually, I think, and as I say, we haven't asked from the start. We actually haven't asked for very much. I think all of this is going to be a matter for the subsequent public inquiry. And I'm sad to say, actually, I think a lot of the things that we were saying about the long-term effects are going to bear out. But it'll be past the event by then.
Right. And finally, William, just on the kind of two-party system, there's talk in America, I don't know whether it will happen, that Donald Trump is thinking about forming his own party, which may be called the Patriot Party. If he's got such a big base, could that be, say, an example of how to bust the two-party system? Because he could take an awful lot of votes away from the Republicans.
I'm fairly sceptical about his ability to do that. I'm not saying his base isn't very significant and strong. I think it is. But I think, across the Anglosphere, we tend to have two-party systems for some reason. It's interesting. Canada has had a change recently. But basically, the states have one. We have one. Ireland has one. Australia, New Zealand basically have them. I think the voting system is connected to it, because if you can get people in parliament, you've got a chance, actually. And then people can at least convene and put different ideas forward. I mean, I've always said that the worst number of political parties in a country is one, and the second worst is two.
Yes, well, I think we can probably agree on that one as well. William, good to talk to you. Thank you. Happy birthday to the SDP. 40 years old today. William Clouston, their leader of the Social Democratic Party. Very much an anti-lockdown party. But, you know, again, that's a phrase that sounds negative, anti-lockdown. It's not anti-lockdown as such. It is actually sensible to ask questions about whether the lockdown is working, when the lockdown can be relaxed, why the lockdown can't be relaxed, if the schools can be opened, when can they be opened. These are all questions that every parent and every individual citizen of this country wants to know the answers to. Why can we not fly somewhere? Why can we not get on a train? Why can we not drive to Scotland and go and see our relatives? Why can we not do all of these things that the government, who we pay, basically, say that we can't do? By the way, what a disgrace that it was revealed in the Sunday Times yesterday. Let me just put this one out there. That MPs are now claiming for the extra electricity and gas that they're using working from home. This at the same time as claiming for their expenses as they would normally do if they were working in London in Parliament. What's that all about? Don't you think that that is a disgrace?
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Do you remember when they said it might be a good idea to come back from the Christmas holidays, perhaps a week late? Schools might wish to stay closed for an extra week just to take care of any infection that might have happened over the course of the Christmas holidays, despite the fact that very few people actually could do very much at Christmas after Christmas was more or less cancelled by the government. It then became a couple of weeks. It then became, well, maybe up until half term, middle of February, perhaps. Maybe after that, people can go back. Now, Gavin Williamson, who is, of course, the Education Secretary, is expected this week to announce that actually that's not very likely to happen either. And it's probably more likely to be Easter before children can come back to school. Now, I'm aware that there are still children being taught in school. I'm aware that children of key workers and vulnerable children are still going to school and that teachers are still working. I'm also aware of the fact that my own children are getting much better online learning than they were back in April and May of last year. However, you know, this is really not something that we can put up with for a very long time. And several Tory MPs are now agreeing with what we've been saying here at Talk Radio for a while. Steve Bryant, former Public Health Minister and Conservative MP for Winchester, has supported the Us For Them campaign. Steve, a very good morning to you.
Morning.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. I mean, we talk an awful lot to people with children, many of whom are working from home now, many of whom are struggling to homeschool their kids and supervise them, even though they're being given assignments from school, particularly, you know, some primary school kids. We sort of need a plan here, don't we?
You're not kidding, we do. I thought you put it very well when you sort of gave that awful rundown of what it will be, and then, oh, then we'll have this, then we'll have that. I think that this weekend, because parents maybe have been a bit of snow and they've seen their children, seems a little bit of a twinkle in their eye again. I think this weekend parents have started to see some of the news headlines and they've started to think, this is going to go on a lot longer than we thought. Yeah. I think people put up with it last year. I think even at the turn of the year, they thought, okay, you know, we understand. It's a bit of a January. And now, May? I think the argument that I'm setting out is that once you've vaccinated the top four most vulnerable groups, and you've given it a few weeks for that to take effect, you've reduced the risk of mortality from COVID by about 90%, the risk of hospitalizations by more than 50%. You need to start bringing our economy and our society back to life. Yes. And the first piece of that jigsaw is our schools, which the government rightly says is its priority. So what we're asking for now is that ministers set out a plan to bring some clarity for this. And I heard Jeff Barton, who leads the Association of College Lecturers Union, this morning on the media saying that school leaders would like that clarity as well. And I sure as hell know that parents and children do.
They absolutely do, because it's the not knowing, I think, that really frustrates so many people. I mean, we speak to Neil Oliver up in Scotland every week, and he was saying that one of his children, 17-year-old, who had previously been talking about wanting to go to Juilliard, maybe in New York, you know, travelling far and wide around the world, is now sort of walking around the house, kicking her heels, kind of saying things like, what's the point of doing anything?
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really, really dangerous.
And we keep hearing, don't we? I mean, Anne Longfield was out on the media this morning talking about the mental health impacts of all of this on children. And we sort of say that almost slightly glibly, because it becomes a thing that we say. But actually, you know, look into what you know, look into what you see as the mental health impacts of this on children. The slightly withdrawn, the what's the point mentality. And that's why I think this is now becoming such an issue, and it's coming to a head, is because we have the rollout of the vaccine. Mm. It is going well. It's not that we're asking for some arbitrary timetable. We think that it should be linked to key milestones in the rollout of the vaccine. On Saturday, we had 500,000 almost vaccines delivered. And the government are very keen, rightly, to laud the success in the rollout of the vaccine. Yeah. But then they don't give us any hope as to what that means. They can't have it both ways. So we've set a date at the start of March, which frankly is regrettably not right after half term when I'd like it to be, because of what I've said about vaccinating the top groups and then letting the vaccine take effect, which will then lead to, that's tied to those groups, lead to reduction in hospitalisation and deaths. And we're asking for a plan just simply based on the milestones, on the evidence, so that school leaders and parents and children can have some hope and know what to expect. Mm, I don't think that is unreasonable.
Well, no, I think it's absolutely perfectly reasonable. It's something also I've been asking for in all areas of our society as well, not just in schools, but obviously schools, as you say, very, very important keystones for everything else, because we need to see some targets. You know, for example, at what point will it be decided that, you know, we can live with whatever level of coronavirus is in society? Because clearly it's going to be here for a while. I heard this morning a couple of good ideas, people suggesting why not look at area by area schooling, so that, you know, if you've got an area where there is a very low intensity of infection, you know, could you open the schools there without necessarily opening all schools?
Well, yes. And I think Jenny Harries, Dr. Harries from Public Health England, actually said that at a Downing Street press conference a week or so ago. But I mean, the wider point here is that, you know, we clearly we have a moving situation with COVID and variants. Everybody understands that. Mm. But I think the government, the public now need to understand the government's philosophy. Now we have a vaccine. You know, I always understood it to be that we should contain the virus until science saves us and the cavalry comes over the hill. Well, the cavalry's over the hill and it's in open fields. And the most vulnerable are being protected at an impressive rate through the vaccination program. And now success seems to be about case numbers. It seems to be about how we're going to protect those that refuse to have the vaccine. You know, are we seriously in this country considering a zero COVID strategy? I really hope not, because that is a council of despair and impossible. So, you know, the Prime Minister said last year that keeping schools closed a moment longer than absolutely necessary was socially intolerable, economically unsustainable, and morally indefensible.
Yes. Well, he keeps saying that he's not doing things that he wants to do. He keeps saying he doesn't want to do things. We keep hearing they don't want to shut schools. Mm. You know, we keep hearing that. He said schools were safe one Sunday interview with Andrew Marr. The next day, the schools were shut. You know, and I've heard also disturbing arguments being made by those who don't want to open schools, saying, well, the problem with just opening schools because teachers are vaccinated is the vaccination doesn't stop you getting COVID. Well, yeah, but, you know, so what does that mean then? Does that mean we never reopen them?
Well, exactly. That's what I mean by the council of despair. And, you know, Jenny Harries, again, was giving evidence to the Education Select Committee just last week. And she said, you know, at the moment, there is no significant evidence that schools are drivers of infection. Mm. It's very much a closed community, she said. Look, you know, flu is virulent in the community in any year. And people die of flu, vaccinated or otherwise. But it can be a very dangerous virus, but we have a vaccine for it. We now have a vaccine for this.
Yeah.
So the most vulnerable in society will be vaccinated. You know, we can't. And if you're a teacher and you're in that vulnerable category, you will have been vaccinated by the 15th of February as well. So my argument, and I said this in Parliament 2 weeks ago, so I'm no Johnny come lately here, is that if reopening schools is the government's priority, and I know that it is, then we'd like to see the money, please.
Yes.
And that does mean vaccinating teachers, police officers and frontline supermarket workers at the top of phase two. So after the 15th of February deadline, because frankly, once that's then happened, what can then be the objection of the teaching unions to reopening schools? They are safe environments And we have to balance the risk against all the other impacts on our young people of not doing so. Yes, it's about our young people and their mental health, but it's also about the mental health of their parents. Mm. And we cannot go on like this. As I said, you know, if we are seriously considering a zero COVID strategy in this country, then we are going to be disappointed. And it feels a bit like every time we meet a milestone, the goalposts then move back again. Not good enough. We have to learn to live with this. As Patrick Vallance said last week, COVID is going to be with us forever. Mm. It will just be contained. Well, it's being contained by the vaccine, and we have a good rollout of that. We need to move on from this once hospitalizations start to fall and deaths start to fall, which could happen very quickly.
Yeah.
And you know what? The problem that I have, and we've discussed this before, is that Parliament is a shadow of itself. It is not able to hold the government to account properly because there are so few people in there. We need to grasp that nettle, however difficult it is. And we need the opposition to start asking difficult questions and the media to start asking difficult questions, other than, frankly, talk radio are the only ones who seem to be doing so. Yeah. Around unlock.
Yeah, we're taking a lot of flack for it as well, by the way.
Oh, Steve. Yeah. Well, you will, because you see, the trouble is there is this narrative that as soon as people question, then they are somehow deniers. And we are somehow, you know, we are the dangerous ones. And frankly, those of us, that is a scandal. Those of us that are asking questions of our elected government, that doesn't make us libertarians. It doesn't make us people who dare to dissent from the Westminster consensus. It makes those of us who are doing that the ones who are doing our jobs.
Yes.
And I think that there is coming a point in this country where public opinion is going to flip. And as I said right at the start of this conversation, I think parents are going to lead that flip. I think this weekend you have seen parents up and down the land having conversations across the dinner table saying, you know, this is a problem. Mm. And once public opinion starts to flip, then maybe you will see the opposition start to flip too.
Well, I wonder, because you make a very good point about the mental health of the family as well as just the children. Because let's face it, you know, there's not very many people who are attached to Westminster who understand what goes on up and down the country, that many people don't even have a dinner table to sit and talk across, that an awful lot of people live in very cramped conditions, an awful lot of people find it incredibly frustrating to get up and have to spend every single day with their family and their kids all staring at the same four walls.
Yeah, no, quite. I mean, you know, we have opposition day in Parliament today. The Labour Party are discussing council tax and employment rights, both very important subjects. But, you know, consequently, there are no urgent questions and there are no statements granted today because the understanding is we won't take away their time for their debates. You know what? There's going to be no money to pay for your council tax unless we have any sort of economy. There's going to be no employment for our young people to go to have rights in unless we get them educated. You know, we're sinking fast here. We need a plan. We need to grip this. And that's all we're saying, is that we need a plan that goes in lockstep with the vaccination programme. And if that makes me a troublemaker and a rebel rouser and all those other words that I get called, well, guilty.
Well, as they say in Casablanca, welcome to the fight. This time I know we will win. Because we have to, Steve. There is simply no other choice for it. I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much indeed. Steve Bryan, former Public Health Minister, Conservative MP for Winchester, top man, as what I would say, supports the Us for Them campaign, knows precisely what it is that needs to be done. And what needs to be done is what we've been saying for weeks and weeks and weeks. The schools need to be reopened. The teachers need to be vaccinated. We need to get on with the rest of our lives before it all dwindles away down the gurgler. This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham, Talk Radio.
Time to say a very, very good morning to Mr. Peter Hitchens. Peter, welcome. How are you?
Good morning. So far, so good.
Excellent.
Lovely morning.
Yes, it's beautiful, isn't it? I mean, unfortunately, I didn't get any snow exposure yesterday because where I was, it didn't actually reach. And by the time I got back to London, it had gone. So I don't know whether your Oxford
We had a little in Oxford. A lot of people rushed out and made snowmen. In fact, all over the hill, quite near where I live, people were making snow families.
I'm not entirely certain whether there are any COVID restrictions that have been issued about snow. I'm surprised people knew what to do.
I wasn't sure. I wondered whether the police might come out and tell us all to go home and stop enjoying themselves. But I think the snowball squad would probably also.
Yes. I mean, you've had an interesting weekend as ever. Obviously, I read your column with interest. The attacks on you continue, some of them from official sources, some of them unofficial. What are you making of it all?
Well, I think that it was something that I predicted, that the supporters of this lockdown have got mixed up with the Cultural Revolution. And an awful lot of people on the cultural and liberal left, the Blairites, who want a stronger state and a generally more regulated and less free society, are riding on this. And obviously they see anybody like me who gets in the way as a considerable nuisance. And there are a lot of them. And when I say Blairites, I generally include pretty much all of the Conservative Party as well, and a very large part of the media. So I've made a lot of enemies, but I think one of Winston Churchill's many wise remarks, if you haven't made any enemies in your life, you probably haven't done anything of any importance or interest. So that's all right.
Right.
What's important is that people such as me keep on standing up to it, because if there is no opposition in the country, that country is automatically less free. So it's a sort of moral duty in a way to keep on at it, even when I personally am quite sick of the arguments in many cases and would dearly love to start writing again at length about other things. Yes. I have occasionally stretched out into that. The fact is, if those of us who feel this has been a mistake stop saying so, then the country becomes completely monolithic and sinks into a sort of torpid tyranny where everybody thinks the same thing. And people get into trouble for speaking out. We can't have that, can we?
So well, we can't. Absolutely
right. But on my part, is worth doing.
No, of course. And I've noticed of late, in the last week or so, that the criticism of people like you, though, has taken a slightly sinister turn, in as much as they're no longer accusing you of getting it wrong. They're now accusing you of being actively sort of dangerous.
Yes, I mean, I think that is a totalitarian step. The idea that a person himself is dangerous is obviously means that person should in some way be restrained. I wouldn't like to go any further down the road of speculation there. Mm. This kind of thinking is dangerous, and my knowledge of history, slice as it is, tells me that quite often it's been a fairly rapid descent from reasonably free societies into the most terrible tyrannies, because people haven't been careful about this sort of thing. So I warn anybody who uses this kind of language to be very careful, not least because if things turn bad, it's quite likely to be used against them. And anybody who leads a mob very rapidly often finds himself being chased by the same mob. So be careful what forces you stir up. I still, as I say, absolutely insist on tolerance, on assuming that my opponents have good motives, as I believe that I have, and that we are all members of the same country and the same society trying to work out things for the best by having a civilized debate about it. And I wish more of them would do the same. But there's so much of this denier stuff, which we discussed, I think, last week, the dog whistle smear, and it was nonsense. Who's denying anything? And then you get this ridiculous magazine, Private Eye, which used to be an independent satirical anti-establishment magazine, is now an establishment rag.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm amazed how that has happened. It has become literally, you know, everything that it used to rail against.
Well, almost. I mean, it's still regarded. The thing is, like almost all people who've climbed into the establishment from having been radical in the past, they still regard themselves as terribly revolutionary and funky. But the fact is that what they do by attacking independent journalism is the government's work. And I just think that people ought to be aware of the way in which institutions and newspapers and magazines change under these circumstances. And the whole idea of a satirical magazine attacking independent journalism, attacking dissent, is ludicrous. But they doesn't even cross their mind.
No. And what is it that their beef is with you exactly?
Well, I don't know. I think maybe some of it's slightly personal. I've no idea. Private Eye have been having a go at me on and off since the late 1970s, when they discovered I'd once been a Trotskyist. something I never made a particular secret
no.
of. I remember calling me back when I was industrial correspondent in the Thatcher era, a Trotskyite defector, and recounting pretty unimportant stories of minor things that happened to me in industrial correspondent. That's normal. That's life. But this is slightly different. Actually, a year ago now, more than a year ago, when I was working on the extraordinary business of the chemical weapons controversy over Syria, they also attacked me over that. And for as I say, independent dissenting journalism, which is something which one of their founding figures, Paul Foote, was very much in favour of. So I just find, oh, for goodness sake. But it's a sign of the change of things, that all the people, almost all the people who were radical in the 1960s and 1970s have now climbed into the establishment. Mm. And it turns out that their radicalism was only against the old establishment, which they got rid of. Once they are in any kind of position of authority or power themselves, they seem to have lost any kind of respect for dissent or free speech. Mm. And they weren't, as it turns out, radical because they were left wing. They were radical because they weren't in power. Yeah. Now they're in power. They're as conservative as any sort of horrible old continental despotism.
Yes. Do you think that the well of kind of independent thought and journalism has been poisoned by money to some extent? Because, you know, when you and I first got into journalism, it was not considered to be a business that you would get very wealthy doing. We did it largely because we were curious. I myself quite liked causing trouble. I quite liked asking awkward questions. I quite liked putting people on the spot. I never dreamed that I would actually make quite a lot of money out of doing it. But an awful lot of people now are making a great deal of money out of the journalism they're doing. And I wonder whether that's kind of coloured their thought process.
It might have done. Certainly, the trade has completely changed. It wasn't at all respectable when I joined.
No,
I think my sort of upper lower middle class parents were quite embarrassed. A thing, and it was generally seen as pretty in for a dig to be a newspaper reporter. And as for working on the popular press, as opposed to the unpopular press, that was bad too. It has undergone a huge revolution in status, and it is much better rewarded than it used to be, I think.
Yeah.
I think that the top writers of my early years at the Daily Express, people like George Gale, I think they'd be amazed at the sort of money which people are making out of comment journalism now. Mm. Of course, George, who was one of my great supporters in my early career, he'd made his reputation doing quite dangerous reporting from Africa in the days of the Congo and Katanga and all the rest of it. And he was a proper reporter who'd come into comment, as I think people should do, as a result of factual knowledge and experience. But I think something very showbizy and semi-political has happened to what used to be a pretty unrespectable, raucous trade, and I'm not sure it's changed for the better.
No, I think that's right. And also, there seems to be a view abroad, certainly in political journalism, that the pinnacle of what you can do is not to be the editor of a newspaper or to be a columnist, but it is to go and work in Downing Street, you know, like Allegra Stratton's done and like Alistair Campbell did. And so therefore, you know, they don't want to sort of, muddy the waters too much, and they don't want to upset too many people.
No, this came to me many years. The first time I ever got into real trouble in journalism, I was brought back from Moscow in the Kinnock major election, was in 1992, by an editor who wanted me to have a go at Neil Kinnock, which I duly did.
Right.
And there was the extraordinary episode, incomprehensible, inexplicable now, called Jennifer's Ear, about a poor girl who featured in a Labour political broadcast. And this got me into trouble with the other journalists. I remember being savaged by the first time I've ever given a press conference by my colleagues.
Right.
And a couple of them later on, who had been journalists at the time and waving their microphones in my face, later went off to work for what one might call major institutions of the establishment. And I thought, that's completely strange to me. For me, the whole idea was to stay in journalism and climb to whatever bit of it you could be happiest in, not to use journalism as a stepping stone to government, but increasingly it is that.
Yeah.
And some journalists seem to me, the ones who cover politics, seem to me to have got far too close to government for their own good and for the good of their readers.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. And I think so many of them, in the days when you could have dinner parties, would be having dinner parties at which MPs and members of the cabinet would be in attendance. And I just think that's way too cozy. I mean, if I was running a newspaper, I would ban all journalists from ever mingling with politicians in anything other than a bar.
Well, there was a lot of lunching when I was in the parliamentary lobby in the 1980s. I can't stand lunch anymore because I associated with sitting around tables with politicians. But it wasn't. Lunch is not quite the same as dinner, and a restaurant is not quite the same as home. And we knew perfectly well that what we'd done is we'd bought their time.
Yeah.
And that's what was going on. I don't think any of us, one or two may have regarded individual politicians as friends. But I never did. I thought they will be friendly to me as long as it suits them, and I'll do the same. But that's as far as it goes. But I think it's got a lot more incestuous since then.
Yes. Now, what do you make of what's just come out? You may not have seen it, but Boris Johnson basically saying today, I think he was out and about doing something. I saw him on television wearing a mask, talking to somebody on the TV. He's talking about the possibility of reviewing the lockdown situation on February the 15th, which, of course, is the date by which we're told they'll have rolled out millions more vaccinations to the top four most vulnerable groups. I mean, maybe some of what we are doing is cutting through to them.
Well, I don't know. I've always applied the rule of opposites with Mr. Johnson. As soon as he says something isn't going to happen, it does.
Right.
And as soon as he says something is going to happen, it doesn't.
Right.
So I'm not going to get my hopes up. I noticed that it was reported on Saturday that the powers enabling councils to continue to close down pubs and restaurants have been extended into July now, I think,
yeah.
Quietly and without much fuss or announcement. So I'd be delighted if this turns out to be the beginning of the end, or the end of the beginning, or whatever it is. I'm not sure that it will. There's an awful lot of people in government, it seems to me, who would want to prevent that from happening. And who knows what leaks about new deadly alien viruses will come out in the next few weeks. And I also find that this whole atmosphere being created by the current wave of government propaganda. You know, look into the eyes of this person. Can you truly say?
Oh, I know. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's quite rude, because say what you like about the British population's attitude towards this, there is no doubt that millions of people have put themselves to a great deal of inconvenience and unpleasantness because they believe that they're doing good to their fellow creatures by staying inside and not going out and not mixing. And to respond to this by a barrage of propaganda saying, watch out or you'll kill this person, it seems to me to be just wrong. Or are they just preparing us for the next stage where they'll say, look, you haven't been good enough. You haven't stayed at home enough. You've breathed too hard, yeah, or whatever it was. So now we're going to introduce yet more regulations. I think that the map of the next few weeks is still cloudy and unclear.
Yeah.
The vaccination, as you rightly say, has been a rare government success. They do seem to have actually got quite a lot of people vaccinated. But, of course, the vaccination doesn't have an immediate impact. The person who's vaccinated isn't apparently immune for some time afterwards. So we need to wait a bit. But if only that were to become the route out, I would be among the happiest of people.
Oh, I think so. And I think an awful lot of people who are getting the vaccination do feel much better for having had it, and they feel as though that is some form of sort of relief for them, because it shows that there is possibly a way out. But I think the problem with all of this advertising and propaganda, as you put it, is that it creates a two-tier society in a way, because it creates fear in some people we had a call last week from a woman who said that she went to get her mother from a care home, and she took her out for an outing. They were going to go to a shop, and the woman was terrified of going out because she thought she was breaking the law. And she didn't want, you know, she was one of those decent British people who didn't want to be associated with law breaking, right? And then you get other people.
Any of us do want to be associated with law breaking, do we? There's two issues here. One, we like to keep to the law. Two, we don't want to, if there is any force in these regulations, whether one doubts or not, one has to leave open the possibility that there is. You don't want to be the person who scoffs at it and did damage. And also there's a simple question of manners, good manners to other people who do believe differently. So I know this wants to break the law, but the problem is if you have a country in which the law is so vague and the boundary between the laws and advice is so unclear, and in which it's no longer possible ever to be sure what is and what is not legal, then that undermines the whole idea of the rule of law, which is a voluntary thing where good people simply abide by the law because they believe in it. And if the law is too unclear to abide by, then you're lost.
Well, that's
also
right.
The law should start from the principle you're free unless,
yes,
rather than unless we say so, you can do things.
Well,
it's
that's
the wrong
right.
Way.
Well, exactly right. And I mean, you know, we are often accused by the people who call us, you know, COVID deniers, that we're encouraging others to break the law, which we are certainly not doing. And I've never encouraged anybody not to socially distance or not to wear a mask when asked to do so. But this is the other thing, that if you have adverts, as we do currently on this radio station, over which I obviously have no control, which finish with a line that says, don't bend the rules because people will die, a lot of other people will listen to that and say, well, I'm sorry, I don't believe that. And then they will not heed the warning.
There has always been a problem with publicity of this kind. I mean, personally, I'm very much in favour of a huge national effort to stop people from smoking, because I've seen personally the consequences of smoking on the lives of people who do it and on their families. And it's something we should discourage. But when the anti-smoking campaigns have got too graphic and too horrifying, The actual evidence has been people have stopped listening.
Yeah,
you can't push too hard. You can't be too cruel and too graphic, or people just say that's too much. There may be a danger here of pushing the button. They've been so successful so far in the creation of fear that they may think they can do it limitlessly, but they may reach the limit as well, and that might also as a result create a lessening of observance of the law and the rules, which would be the exact opposite of what they intend. They should be a bit more careful and also a lot more respectful of the good judgment of the people they're advertising to.
Yes, I think so. And also, I think it's time, as we have consistently asked, and I think you have as well, for more actual data which supports what it is that they're doing, particularly with regard to lockdown, particularly with regard to the cost of that, the benefit of it, you know, the effect of it, not just economical, but the mental health problems that people are getting as well.
Well, I think that this comes back to us. I think we can expect them to do that. They're in this now. They've been wading in it so far that it would be too much trouble for them to go back or to admit they're wrong. But there will be an inquest into this in some form or another. And at that point, those of us who have opposed it are going to need to come up with the facts and the figures about lockdown, about whether it was effective in the way that it was intended to be, what it cost, whether the cost of it could conceivably be justified by the effect that it had, even if it was effective, and therefore whether we should ever do it again, to which my answer would have to be no. This is the thing we never did before. No one's ever attempted with an epidemic or a pandemic with this method before. It doesn't seem to me to have worked particularly well this time. It's done immense amounts of damage. But it really is, because the government itself is not going to back down, it really is up to independent thinkers. And this includes, it seems to me, many people who up till now sat on the edge of the argument and not joined in properly. For them to say, once this is over and the panic propaganda has stopped, actually, this wasn't a wise thing to do. It was an overreaction. And here I come back to what I said from the start. It was disproportionate. And the cost to the country and society and to life and health and education and to the healthy old has been colossal and unjustifiable. And we shouldn't ever do it again.
I think that's a very good point on which to end. We are still trying to work out the Dan Hodges, Peter Hitchens head-to-head proper debate, which we'll be doing soon. We're going to be asking you for some dates, I think, Peter, once you're off air. Our producers will try and line that up, and we'll be doing that soon. Peter, thank you very much, as ever, for talking to us. Man on Sunday columnist Peter Hitchens there with his latest take on what Boris Johnson's been saying about lifting restrictions, about what is going on out there by and large, and about how, of course, these people who criticise people like him and people like me and people like Julie Hartley-Bruin accuse us of somehow encouraging people to do dangerous things. Absolute and utter nonsense, rubbish and absolute rot, quite frankly. This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, it might not have occurred to you that here in this country we have gone through something of a kind of counter-revolution, to the point where culture wars have taken the place of an awful lot of what used to be considered to be reasonable conversation. There are certain things that you now cannot say. There are certain things that you now cannot think. And there are certain things that, as far as some people are concerned, you shouldn't even have occur to you. But let us talk now about an organisation called Counterweight, because this is Helen Pluckrose's idea. Let's find out what it's all about. Helen, a very good afternoon to you.
Hello, lovely to be here.
Yes, thank you very much indeed for joining us. What made you come up with this idea, first of all? Because I think it's long overdue, to be honest.
After the death of George Floyd and the BLM protest, there was just so many emails, all of us in this space who have been concerned about critical social justice approaches were getting panicked emails from people who were having to do really quite authoritarian diversity training and affirm things they didn't believe. So there were so many, we set up a Discord server so we could triage the most urgent cases, give generalized advice, and Counterweight has formed out of it. Our project coordinator worked in the past with the Citizens Advice Bureau.
Right.
And so she's applied a lot of the similar methods to it, to a caseworker system. And it's working. It's working really well.
And what sorts of advice can you give? I mean, say for example, I was reading some of the stuff that you've dealt with in the past, where, for example, you know, some organisations have become sort of overrun by people apologising for things that it's not really their fault to apologise for. You know, like people sending emails to their bosses complaining that, you know, they feel guilty about something that happened in the past. You know, statues have been taken down as a result. You know, this kind of thing, and it does seem to have changed the way we live, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I think people have a right to believe this if people do feel guilty about their race or their sex, and they believe themselves to have been socialised into white supremacist or patriarchal beliefs or whatever else, they have the right to believe that. What they don't have the right to do is insist that other people believe that. Mm. The people we hear from mostly are white people who don't believe that they're racist and don't want to affirm that they are, and black and South Asian people who don't want to be forced to testify to a very theoretically specific experience of racism. So we're a liberal humanist organization. We believe as liberals that people can evaluate ideas and reject or accept them.
Right. And what has happened, do you think, to the people in society who would have previously kind of defended basically what you're defending, which is the right to have a series of personal thoughts, a series of personal beliefs, which you don't necessarily want to preach to people every Saturday at Speaker's Corner, but which you want to be able to hold dear to yourself without somehow being criticised or worse, being painted as some kind of mad extremist?
That's what we're seeing at the moment. We're seeing a loss of liberalism, that idea of that respect for the marketplace of ideas, the idea of plurality. We can coexist while having different approaches to things. And this, I mean, I've looked at the scholarship. Other sociologists have looked at what social change is, why is this happening. I recommend The Coddling of the American Mind and The Rise of Victimhood Culture. They're both very relevant, but I've looked at the scholarship and the activism and what's coming out of the universities, and it's really very much based at the moment on a Robin DiAngelo approach or a queer theory approach, where it really is believed that by not believing the right ideas about these invisible systems of power and privilege, you are perpetuating oppressive systems. You have to say the right things to fix things. Discourses are dangerous. So if you mustn't sort of suggest that woman is a biological category, because otherwise you're contributing to an environment that kills trans women.
Yes.
This is a belief now.
This is something that I've noticed actually on social media, that now if you have, for example, a view about anything, you're accused of causing harm. That seems to be a tactic that certain people now use, because they've worked out that it's not enough to disagree with you or to try and stop you saying something. They now try and make an accusation which you can't possibly really defend, because it's so sort of ethereal. It doesn't really exist in the real world. I mean, I've been told by, for example, sort of what I regard as rather radical cyclists, who want the entire world, you know, turned into a massive cycle lane and cars to be banned, that I somehow, by criticising the imposition of cycle lanes in London, that I'm somehow encouraging people to do harm to cyclists, which, of course, is rubbish.
OK. Okay, right. Well, we might disagree on cycling, but generally I think, the idea is that reality is socially constructed in discourses by ways of speaking about things. And if you truly believe this, and I think we have to accept that social justice activists and scholars really do believe this, then speech really does do harm. Mm. If somebody like J.K. Rowling with a big platform says that she believes woman is a biological category, then there's going to be a massive flashback. And if we look at how it happened with people saying, chanting the mantra back, trans women are women, trans women are women, trans women are women, because of this focus on language, we have to undo the harm done by certain language and replace it with better language. And this doesn't work with the liberal marketplace of ideas or with the conservative respect for personal authority or, you know, with religious beliefs in free will. So
it's a dangerous rocky road, isn't it? Because, you know, while there are some things that you would prefer, that I suppose that the law would protect you against, for example, people using hate speech against other people, you know, that. But the trouble is hate speech has now become expanded into all kinds of areas, hasn't it?
I think hate speech is a very difficult obviously some speech is hateful, but how do you judge someone's feelings? I think the issue has to be harassment.
Yeah.
You know, are you forcing people to hear things they don't want to hear? Are you following them? Are you threatening them? Are you intimidating them? If you just believe something that they don't believe and that hurts them. You know, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. Now, this means that some people can be very, very badly hurt by my beliefs. And historically, I would have been punished for them and possibly killed.
Yeah.
So this is a very human thing, but we don't want to see a resurgence of it. And I'm afraid we are.
Yes, I know. And I mean, do you think it all started in the sort of hallowed halls of academia? Because it seems to me that that's where it began. But I don't know if that's right.
Yeah, there's a feedback loop that goes on, because it's significant that this started just as the liberal civil rights movement, gay pride, feminism had won their main legal battles. So these had been won in the courts, but obviously racism, sexism, homophobia hadn't gone away. So what remained was to tackle attitudes. So scholars have focused on that. Postmodernism, the idea of that discourses and beliefs and knowledge as a social construct was very useful. So we have these different kinds of scholarship grow up. Activists became able to use it, apply it to everything. And it's got deeply simplified into the things we see from people like Robin DiAngelo. If you are white, you are racist. Yeah. You cannot help but be racist.
Right. And what about the idea that somehow, interestingly, that you said you were an atheist? Because I've read people writing that because of the kind of disappearance to a large extent of an awful lot of mainstream religion, that people have kind of latched onto this movement, as it were, because people inevitably want to belong to something. They want to be part of a group. They want to be something that they can associate with and have people around them that agree with them, almost like if it was a religion.
I think that critical social justice meets a lot of the same psychological and social needs that religion does. And this is why I think we need to apply the rules of secularism to it. You have the right to believe this, to express this, to live by this. Mm. You cannot force it on anyone else. There's a simplistic sort of substitution theory where some people claim that because religion is decreasing, social justice is increasing. But that doesn't work geographically.
Right.
America remains the most religious place in the Anglosphere, and it also has the most critical social justice wokery.
Yes.
So it's not quite as straightforward
that's true, actually. Yeah, interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's a bit like when I look around in parts of the city I live in, where pubs have been converted into places of worship, you know, in a rather kind of bizarre twist, which we could probably talk about all day. But what do you think is going to happen, say, for example, Helen, in the next sort of 12 months or so? Because I sense, and I don't know whether you would agree with this, that while this is a massive problem and has been a problem, you know, relatively recently, it's not quite as big a problem as maybe it was in the summer of last year.
From the input I'm getting, it's still a significant problem. We still have a lot of cases ongoing, but I think that we're also seeing a lot of recognition of the problem. And we're seeing more and more people willing to push back. So we have got quite a few of our members have got themselves onto equity, diversity and inclusion boards, where they are trying to keep viewpoint diversity open and trying to avoid really narrowly social justice ideas. We've got open whistleblowers, obviously, but a lot of people don't want to do that. They don't want to punish anyone or cancel anyone. They just want to make things a bit freer. So I don't think things are getting better yet. I think they might well get worse before they get better. But I think that the seeds are there for saying enough is enough. You've gone too far now. We need some reason.
And I know that you probably would need a bit more nuance than this. But say, for example, if somebody is, I don't know, going for a job interview and they got asked, and they get taken down this kind of road of woke questions, and as a result, perhaps they don't get a job because they didn't say the right thing. What recourse do they have currently, if any?
Well, we're speaking to various trade unions about this at the moment and lawyers, and it all seems to be quite vague.
Yeah.
But on an ethical level, we've had a couple of people who have just refused one person that we're working with, he has refused to undergo unconscious bias training on the grounds that it's demeaning to him as a black man, so he has a little less danger of being called racist. He's told that this will be represented in his performance review and it will directly affect his income. This isn't acceptable. It's no more acceptable than if a Christian employer were forcing a Muslim employee to pretend to believe that Jesus was the son of God or something.
Also, religious assembly every morning or something like that. I mean, you can see how it is going to be very, very tricky in terms of legal and sort of ethical work. How do people get in touch, Helen, if they need to?
Counterweightsupport.com is our website, and in the middle up there, if you're having an emergency, Dave, get help. Otherwise, there are a lot of resources that you can just access freely.
Okay, brilliant stuff. Well, great to talk to you, and good luck with the project. I'm sure we'll be speaking again. We may have to seek your guidance on one or two matters over the course of the year. Helen Pluckrose, editor of Ario magazine, co-author of Cynical Theories, and also the setter-upper of Counterweight, as it's now called, an organisation which will operate as if it is a citizens' advice bureau for people who are getting what you might regard as bullied, because that's what it is sometimes, by their employer, into having to either make certain statements or undergo certain training or undergo, you know, certain programming in order to continue to work where they work. Because it's not that clear yet whether any of that stuff is in fact legal.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. Much to do still before Ian Collins comes in just before 1 o'clock to tell us what's coming up on his show. It is Burns Night tonight. For those of you Sassenachs who do not know what that is, it's a celebration of Rabbi Burns, the great Scottish poet, raconteur, and some might say a man who was, shall we say, rather busy in certain other areas as well. We'll come to that in 1 second. Let me just read you this from Barry, who's tweeted in. He says, re-vaccines. Our listeners aware that a young receptionist in an optician's is being vaccinated before a frontline police officer. The government have lost the plot. Well, I think the problem is that government have said healthcare workers, and they've used that as a rather widespread of things, because it also covers social care workers. It also covers foster care workers. It also covers people in hospitals, but it also covers any other health area, which I guess would be an optician's if you're a receptionist. So, I mean, I don't think they've lost the plot as such. I think they're just trying to cover as many bases as they possibly can. But it does make you wonder, doesn't it, whether they're making this decision based upon vaccinating more people than fewer people, because they're not giving the second vaccine out as quickly as they were. I'm sure this will become a conversation that we have continually throughout this week. But do give us a call if you've got some news for us on that front. 0344 499 1000. Right now, though, time to say a very good afternoon to Gillian Stephen, Twinkle's teacher and marketing team lead for Scotland. Gillian, a very good afternoon to you.
Hi there, thanks. for having me on the show.
And a very happy Burns night, I suppose I should say to you. I mean, there was a time when I lived in Scotland and this was a massive deal. We'd always do something like sort of three or four Burns nights. You'd probably do one on a Friday, you'd do one on the Saturday, and then you'd do one on the Monday, because traditionally it's the last Monday, I think, in January, right?
Yeah, traditionally. It's a bit different this year. There's not as many celebrations able to take place out and about. But yeah, usually we would make a big deal of it and have lots of nice evening celebrations.
Yes.
And meals.
And what is the traditional sort of evening celebration consist of? Because there's the, I mean, I find this so great because both my parents are from Scotland and it's always been in my blood. And so I've always, Burns Night has always meant something to me. But for a lot of people, they don't really know what it's all about, do they?
No, not usually. So what happens, the very first Burns Supper actually took place in 1801, which was 5 years after Robert Burns' death, and it was his friends came together just to commemorate him.
Right.
It's grown from there. And basically what would happen is you have big celebrations where people are all invited, you have lots of guest speakers. Traditionally, your haggis would be piped in, your guests would be piped in with a solo piper. There would be an address to the haggis, which is one of Robert Burns' most famous poems, as they're serving the meal. There would be the immortal memory, which is given, which is basically a speech about Robert Burns' life. And then there would be a toast to the lassies, which is usually the kind of more humorous part of the evening. Later on, there's a reply from the toast to the lassies, so the ladies get their say as well. And then the evening would have lots of entertainment, maybe some Highland dancing, more of his songs or poems being read, and then we would usually end with the good old Auld Lang Syne.
Yes. Now, isn't there also a stabbing of the haggis that has to happen as well?
Yes, that's part of the poem. So throughout the address to the haggis, they talk about how they're going to slice open the haggis, and it ends on Gear a haggis, and that's when there would be lots of applause and everyone would get their fine meal, and you've got a nice, yeah, there we go.
Right. There it is. Yeah, I mean, I'm a great one for when I lived in Edinburgh, I used to quite often quite like a bit of haggis in a roll in the morning. Haggis and black pudding with brown sauce was one of the favourite things. I mean, are you one of those people that eats haggis all year round?
I would eat it all year round. I probably wouldn't have it with brown sauce in a roll. No.
It's a very good hangover cure, actually, I have to say. But, I mean, it's a wonderful thing which is celebrated all over the world, isn't it? Rabbi Burns was quite a character because, as I sort of hinted at, he was, I think, several times married. He was somebody who emerged, really, as a foremost of poet. But he kind of also invented his own language a little bit, didn't he?
I think what he's more known for would be keeping the old Scots tradition and language alive. Yeah. So instead of much creating his own, he's made what was actually spoken and read in Scotland at the time. Right. He made that popular. He was very keen to keep old Scots ballads alive. That's why he worked a lot with the Scottish Musical Museum when he moved through to Edinburgh. Yeah. He's responsible for about a third of their 600 song collection. He was only married once, however... There was a very forgiving wife, shall we say?
Well, let's put yes. You know, I think well, there was quite a lot going on in that particular area. And he was from was it Lanarkshire?
No, so he was actually born in Alloway, which is in Ayrshire, and you can still visit that cottage to this day. I actually grew up, and I'm in Aberdeen now, as you can see, but I grew up about 5 miles away from his house. So there was a lot of school trips and family visits to the old cottage. So he was born there and he stayed in Ayrshire until his 20s. And then he was actually planning a move to the West Indies. So I've got a wee bit of information there. It was just after he met the woman who he eventually married, Jean Armour.
Right.
And for some reason, her father was not happy with the match, shall we say.
Yes.
You might have heard about his reputation. So even though she was pregnant with his twins, he was not allowed to marry Jean Armour. So he decided at that point in his life he was going to move to the West Indies and he was going to live in Jamaica. But this is what led to his poem being published. He was trying to raise the fare for the journey to the West Indies. So he released his first publication in 1785, I believe, which was known as Scots Poems, chiefly in the Scottish dialect, which became later known as the Kilmarnock Edition. And with that, he got sudden popularity and changed his plans from moving. And luckily for us, stayed in Edinburgh, moved through from Ayrshire to Edinburgh.
Right.
Where he became really well known.
Right. And was that when he became sort of even more prolific with his poems?
Yes. So he'd obviously been writing for a long time. For somebody who was born into poverty, he actually, his father highly valued education. And so he was enrolled in the Alloway School until it closed due to financial implications. And then his father actually hired a tutor for them. He was tutored by a man called David Murdoch.
Right.
And then was actually able to attend another school later on in Dalrymple, which is another small town in Ayrshire. He was able to attend that school, but only on a weekly basis because he couldn't be spared from the farm.
Uh-huh.
So he shared his role at the school with his brother Gilbert. They would take a week on and a week off. 1 week he would work in the farm, 1 week he would go to school and he would swap with his brother. But despite that, he had, by 18, he had a very good understanding of English literature, Latin, Greek and French, and even a keen interest in trigonometry.
And how would you say he's viewed? Because, I mean, Burns Night, you could probably find a celebration in almost every country in the world somewhere at some point tonight, right? I mean, where does he sit in international ways in terms of literature? What do people think of him who are not from Scotland?
I think the reason that he resonates so readily with people is because everything he writes about is basically the human emotion. It's something that we all experience. He uses quite simple language, even though it's in Old Scots and can sometimes be quite difficult to translate.
Yeah.
Once translated, it's about love, it's about humour, it's about things that we experience the world over. There's actually more statues of Robert Burns than any other literature figure
really? In
the world. There's more statues of him worldwide. His song Auld Lang Syne is in the Guinness World Book of Records as the third most popular song after Happy Birthday and For He's a Jolly Good Fellow, in case
That's
you were
amazing,
interested.
Isn't it? That is amazing. Yeah, because it's sung again every New Year at pretty much every place in the world.
Yeah, and versions of it are actually sang in Japan as part of their education system. Apparently it's sang at graduations. With his background as a farmer and his poetry there, so like To a Mouse and the things that he wrote about nature when he was really out and about, apparently they're very popular in Russia from that time as well. So it's, and then of course with it, like mass immigration of the Scots from his time throughout the years going to Canada and North America, you can see how it kind of grew there as well. There's a very large Scots community who are very proud of their heritage.
And My Love Is Like a Red, Red Rose is a very popular one as well, isn't it?
Yes, it's very popular. There's that and A Fond Kiss and Afton Water. And if you look through a lot of his kind of Scots ballads, you can see places coming up from around about Scotland and especially Ayrshire and finally where he settled in Dumfries.
Yes. Fascinating man. What's if somebody wants to kind of learn more about him, where's a good place to start?
So there would be a lot on your National Museum Scotland website. They have their own Robert Burns Museum in Ayrshire as well, as do Dumfries, where he actually eventually, that's where he died.
Yeah.
He's got his own monument there. And as I say, there's monuments all over the world, but you can learn a lot about him there.
Right.
And the Robert Burns Cottage is a fascinating place to visit, and there's an experience further up. The other really cool thing about that, this is what I used to do when I was younger, obviously don't do this during the pandemic, but when you're able to get out and about, if you start at Robert Burns Cottage and just keep walking, you'll eventually come past the Old Kirk, which features in Tam O'Shanter, and you can continue to walk from there and see the bridge.
The bridge, yes, I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, so in the famous poem where the witches pull the tail off his horse.
Yes.
You can walk over that bridge, and it's just quite nice to be able to get yourself involved in the poetry.
It's lovely. Whenever we used to go down that way, we'd also pop into a place called Electric Bray, which I'm sure you probably know about. Have you been there? You know this place where you park a car in the lay-by, and it looks as though you can basically go uphill without the engine being on. It's one of those weird kind of optical illusions, isn't it?
Optical illusions, yeah. It's my neck of the woods. I'm up in Aberdeen now, but I'm born in that area and know all those areas.
Great part of the world. So what are you doing for Burns Night tonight then? Because obviously nobody can, as you say, go anywhere really.
Yeah, well, I've got two small boys, so my challenge tonight is to see if I can get them to try a little bit of haggis.
Excellent.
It might end up just being neeps and tatties for them.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to ask you the next question then, which is, are you one of those who thinks putting whiskey on it is a good idea?
Or a bit of whiskey cream. Yeah.
Very nice. Excellent. Well, don't give it to the kids. Listen, Gillian, thank you very much indeed. Gillian Stephen Twinkles, teacher and marketing team lead for Scotland on Rabbi Burns, because it is Burns night tonight. So you can celebrate it any day of the week if you like. But if you haven't ever had haggis, you're missing out. So you should definitely try it. And if you don't like the taste of it, just pour some whiskey on it. And that works. A treat.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday, on Talk Radio via DAB, online, or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.